You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The earthquake in Haiti 2 years ago this month took the lives of more than 230,000 people, revealed infrastructural chaos, unleashed a cholera epidemic, left a million citizens homeless, and led to an unprecedented outpouring of aid and attention for the small island nation. Yet most of the media coverage of Haiti scarcely went beyond the familiar stereotypes of it being the land of voodoo, the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, one that's in a state of eternal chaos. Laurent Dubois, professor of Romance Studies and History at Duke University and co-director of the Haiti Lab at the Franklin Humanities Institute, joins us now to provide a more complete picture. He is the author of Haiti, The Aftershocks of History. It is published by Metropolitan Books, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
You spent the first week of this month traveling in Haiti. What can you tell us about your visit?
Well, it's interesting. There's a lot of changes going on, a lot of things afoot at different levels. Still a lot of the infrastructure obviously destroyed in the downtown area, but people have been moving out of camps and you see rebuilding here and there. So it's a somewhat positive sense of forward motion.
Because the novelist Monique Kleska wrote an article titled Blue Haiti, in which she described her country blue the color of the thousands of tarpaulins covering the landscape after the earthquake. So you're still seeing an awful lot of people living in tents?
Yeah, absolutely. There are still a lot of camps. About 500,000 still. So you still have tremendous issues to deal with there.
Is that the main challenge that needs to be overcome?
Well, that challenge is just built up on top of other challenges, right? I mean, housing has always been a major issue in Port-au-Prince, and the relationship of the city to the countryside is a long challenge. So in a sense, the earthquake, really deepened and exposed larger structural issues that are obviously very, very complicated to deal with.
Well, there was so much aid given after the earthquake, and yet it's my sense that it wasn't enough. Was the situation really that dire, or has some of the money gone to places it shouldn't have gone to?
Well, there's really two types of aid. I mean, there was really an emergency disaster relief, which did have a very important impact in Haiti, helped a lot of people, survive who might have died otherwise.
And that's dried up.
And that has, of course, the time for that is the promised aid for reconstruction. Actually, a great deal of it hasn't even really been delivered and is still awaiting various, plans to be put together. So, in fact, a lot of the kind of figures we see are not money that's been delivered, but money that's been promised.
A listener from Brooklyn, George, asked what happened to President Michel Martelly's plan to reinstate the Haitian army?
Well, that's still in discussion. It's a very controversial and complicated issue because the history of the Haitian army is one of, it's a very divisive issue, in fact. So I think he's trying to go ahead with it, but it's obviously raising a lot of questions.
And it's divisive because the Haitian army has been involved in totalitarian governments in the past?
Yes.
Is there fear that another military might do the same thing?
Exactly. I mean, so Aristide is the one who kind of abolished the Haitian army in the wake of the Duvalier dictatorship and the kind of process after Duvalier when the army was basically in control for many years, carried out coups. And there's a much longer, deeper history of a centralized army was first really created actually in Haiti by the U.S. Marines during the occupation. And so there's a long history of the army being a tool more for oppression than liberation.
Well, does Haiti really need an army? Is it facing any kind of imminent danger? A police force could handle most things.
Absolutely. I think obviously maybe a force to help in disaster relief and other kinds of materials, and that's sort of the argument being put forward, but that not the army so much as for external threats, but as a kind of essentially a police force within the country.
How are the authorities and international organizations handling the cholera epidemic? And the cholera epidemic, as I understand it, was not a natural consequence of the earthquake. This is something that was actually brought in by aid workers and caused a certain amount of tension.
Mm-hmm. Well, there had never actually been cholera in Haiti before, as far as we know. Although there had been in other countries, and it's pretty clear now that it came through UN troops. So that created a lot of tension. But it is true that the conditions after the earthquake also of unsanitary water did contribute a great deal to the spread.
Has that been cleaned up at all?
It's underway, but cholera is still a pretty serious threat and danger in Haiti.
Let's go back. Why do you think that Haiti's culture is so often misunderstood? There was a time in the 50s when there was a lot of tourism and a lot of Americans went down there to buy paintings because Haitian art had a fad. But all that seems to be dead.
Yeah, I mean, there has been really a long history until the mid-20th century of many engagements between the U.S. and Haiti. And we have a long history of connections between our two countries.
Not always positive.
Not always positive ones. At the same time, you really have to go back to the beginning, which is Haiti is a country founded by slave revolutionaries in an age when the United States is pretty much committed to slavery. Our leaders are slaveholders. So there's, from the very beginning, a kind of unease and complicated relationship with Haiti.
When the slave revolt occurred, George Washington still president in 1804?
It's Jefferson who's really president at the time when all this is unrolling.
But they were all very uneasy because they were afraid that there would be a slave revolt in this country.
Absolutely. They were extremely worried about the example. They were worried about having black diplomats from Haiti in Washington and what that would sort of say as a challenge to their own racial ideas.
So what had happened? The slaves revolted against a plantation society.
Mm-hmm.
They were a success before anybody else in the Americas, weren't they?
It is. It's really, I mean, it's the first place where you get widespread emancipation. There'd been some emancipation in the northern states, but this is a slave society. 90% of the people are enslaved. They overthrow slavery. They defeat attempts to reinstate it, and they create a totally new society.
And was it one that was based on good ideas, or probably influenced to some degree by the French Revolution?
There was an influence of the French Revolution, a long history of slave resistance. The majority population was actually African-born people. The slave trade had been bringing them at such rates that the majority was African-born. So they pulled together all these different influences in creating a new society.
You say that understanding the roots of Haiti's social organization is vital for any who want to resolve the country's problems today. What was different about the Haitian approach to social organization?
Well, what I use the term, which is a term from a Haitian sociologist, the counter-plantation system. It's a very strong organizing principle throughout the book that coming out of a plantation system and of a population of enslaved people, they created a system that was meant to kind of to get rid of the plantation and refuse the return of the plantation based on autonomy, dignity, self-sufficiency.
And who was running the plantations after they overthrew that system?
Well, they just got rid of the plantations and they took over the
plantation. That meant there was a source of income that was lost.
It was. The sugar plantations were gone. But what Haitians did is they started cultivating coffee, or coffee had been a crop before. They did export coffee, dye wood. So they were involved in export, but they also created a kind of very rich internal economy.
And they share the island with Santo Domingo, where slavery lasted longer than in most parts of the New World.
It's true. I mean, Santo Domingo has a very different history. It was not a major slave. It was not really a plantation colony so much as a smaller colony, although there was slavery there longer.
Well, Haiti's economy was successful in the 19th century. Many people actually immigrated to the country. Could you tell us more about that period?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one that I really emphasize in the book because I think people almost know nothing about that. And it shows a kind of alternative to what we see in the 20th century. This is a country where African Americans migrated to, people from the Middle East, Germans. And actually the mix of the agricultural system they developed was, I think, quite successful.
They were bringing ideas from other parts of the world?
Well, actually, a lot of their knowledge came from the experience, even in slavery, when slaves had to cultivate their own plots of land to feed themselves. So pretty sophisticated agricultural techniques, mixing, again, production for inside with exports.
My guest is Laurent Dubois. His book, Haiti, The Aftershocks of History, it is published by Metropolitan Books. So what went wrong? Why do we then see the United States occupying Haiti from 1915 to 1934? Had it gone into a period of decline?
There was some changes in the 19th century, but a lot of it just had to do with strategic U.S. interest in the Caribbean. So there was a military strategic interest. There was a desire to use Haiti as to create new plantations, as was being done in other parts of the Caribbean.
But we were fighting the war to end all wars in 1915.
It is.
How did we justify invading Haiti?
Well, part of it was justified by the fact that there were Germans in Haiti. There were German merchants there. But it's one of the sad ironies of the book, and I really do give a lot of attention to the U.S. occupation, which people do not know here. But it was a very brutal occupation at this very same time as World War One and under Wilson.
And it's interesting you point out, of course, that this is something that all Haitians are aware of and most Americans are unaware of.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, there's a real disjuncture between – we're a country that's really involved in Haiti, and yet we don't know a lot of the basic facts about the history. It's something I try to deal with in the book.
You say that it had devastating consequences for the country because it change the nature of the economy?
It really did. It kind of transformed a lot of political and economic life in Haiti. And, you know, the plan was to kind of replace what existed with something better, something more modern. And many Haitians even collaborated with the Haitian occupation at first. But what happened was, in a sense, what was there before was kind of destroyed. And I think what was put in its place, in a sense, even worse.
So they had a decentralized approach and they became centralized like most other countries.
It did. I mean, that was the attempt. But in a sense, the centralization was in the direction of trying to have a plantation economy, in a direction that really went against what a lot of Haitians really aspired towards.
And would foreigners be running those plantations?
Absolutely. Well, under the U.S. occupation for 20 years, I mean, it was really directly administered by the Marines, and there was a desire for foreign investment at the time. But there was also resistance to that.
What you say that the effects of the U.S. military occupation are still felt today, mm-hmm. from 1934?
I mean, partly because – so a number of things happened. First of all, the kind of modern Haitian army was constructed, a centralized army. The city of Port-au-Prince became more of a central hub and took over from other rural ports. So there were a bunch of structural changes that had very far-reaching consequences. And it was also the beginning of a long-running U.S.-Haitian kind of connection that we still see today.
And during the occupation, was that when Haitians began to leave the country?
It is really the beginning of this. Again, as people had migrated to Haiti a lot in the 19th century, it's during the U.S. occupation period, many people begin to leave.
And where did they go?
They at first went to Cuba and the Dominican Republic, looking for work in various places. That's the beginning there. But eventually, obviously, the migration would then turn to the United States and North America.
George from Manhattan says he works with Haitian kids and that given the opportunity, most Haitians would love to come to the States. Mm-hmm. He also points out that mahogany was a big part of their economy.
Right. That's true. There's actually a long history of logging that contributes to deforestation. I think Haitians, obviously, yes, many aspire to coming to the United States. The Haitian diaspora is very large and very successful in many ways here. So we need to rethink also the way that our two countries relate in that sense.
When did the deforestation begin? Because I've been told by people who have flown into the island that you can actually see where the border is because there's wood on one side and it's totally bare on the other.
Right, right. Well, again, that goes actually back to the 18th century where Haiti was a really intense plantation society in which there were already some deforestation going on, and the DR was a different kind of society with a smaller population. But obviously it's accelerated a lot in the 20th century.
Now, are part of Haiti's problems that it was a result of a slave revolt and that countries like the United States were afraid of it? Was it isolated from the start?
It was politically isolated. The U.S. only recognized Haiti in 1862. France only recognized Haiti in 1825 after requiring a payment of a large indemnity. So that certainly had consequences.
The indemnity, $3 billion in today's dollars, to the former slave holders.
Exactly.
Because they had lost their property?
Right. Yes, exactly. There was a kind of, you know, it was the price that France levied to sort of open up the trade with Haiti.
Well, how would a new nation ever pay up that kind of debt?
Well, they didn't. I mean, it's a debt that they've kept paying into the 20th century. And it really, I think that did have a pretty devastating consequences on the state treasury.
This is also the time when the country started dividing by class. Mm-hmm. And skin color played an important part, and this is also when the development of the elites started. Mm-hmm. Has that been one of the major problems Haiti has had to face all these years?
Well, there's certainly a major, you know, conflict within Haitian society, a kind of stalemate that I describe in the book between elites with one vision and the larger population with a different one, and it's taken different forms over the years, but it's an ongoing problem.
And what is the vision of the elites as opposed to everyone else?
Early on, the vision was that many really wanted to reconstruct the plantations and the kind of rural population did not want to. But it also has to do with the forms of ruling and democracy and just the kind of the difficulty of participation of the larger groups within Haitian society. That is still a difficult issue.
My guest is Laurent Dubois, who is the Marcello Lotti Professor of Romance Studies and History at Duke University. He's written about Haiti over the years, and his most recent book is called Haiti, The Aftershocks of History. It's published by Metropolitan Books. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Professor Laurent Dubois of Duke University. His latest book, Haiti, The Aftershocks of History, published by Metropolitan Books. So the United States is occupying Haiti from 1915 to 1934, mm-hmm. a long period of time. Right. Was there resistance?
There was. I mean, there was a resistance that not at first, but that developed especially when forced labor was used in Haiti to build roads. And that created a pretty intense war in 1918-1919 that left a lot of people dead and kind of devastated parts of the countryside.
And who was forcing them to work? The U.S. military?
Yeah, the U.S. military used forced labor to build roads in Haiti.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm sure they saw it as for the greater good of the country.
Mm-hmm. It was.
We're modernizing Haiti.
They used Haitian laws, which were on the books, to put that into effect. But nevertheless, it was a kind of a problem for people.
So was there a political opposition? Is this what led to the way Haiti looked after the U.S. left?
Yes. I mean, the other thing is that there's a war, there's a resistance in the countryside, then there's more and more political intellectual opposition in the city, the emergence of a whole new cultural movement that tries to rethink Haiti in relation to the occupation. So it's actually also kind of an interestingly generative time for Haitian culture.
Is it also when people start associating voodoo with Haiti?
Absolutely.
Is that a way of making Haiti into something less respectable?
I think so. I mean, the birth of the zombie films, for instance, this starts in the 1920s, the whole genre of depictions of Haiti. I think in a way we replaced our own dealing with our own relationship to Haiti and our own impact through the occupation with a set of tropes that sort of, in a sense, free us from responsibility to some extent.
Well, my first real awareness of politics in Haiti was when Duvalier was in power, the first mm-hmm. Duvalier's father, Papa Doc. How did he come to power? And how early was that?
So he comes to power in 1956, but he's actually kind of a bit of the product of the United States occupation. He studies in a U.S. medical school. He studied at the University of Michigan, became a doctor working with U.S., and that's how he kind of rose to prominence as a professional. And then he runs for power in 1956, and after an election then begins to construct this very powerful regime.
So he wins the election fair and square?
A lot of debate about that still, but it was an election through which he first came to power.
Later, he makes it into a classic dictatorship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of an hereditary one with his son taking power after him.
They devastated the country.
I think that 30-year period, I mean, we're still taking stock of it, and it's a very controversial period, too. People have very different positions on it. But the economic devastation was, I think, pretty serious, and others as well.
But the United States was fairly friendly over the years, wasn't it?
On the whole, except for Kennedy, who was at first rather negative towards Duvalier, but largely, actually, Duvalier received a lot of support from the U.S., mainly as a counterpoint to Castro's Cuba.
Now, in 1986, Baby Doc, the son, was overthrown, but he didn't look like he was a particularly effective leader. He just had inherited the leadership. Still had been in power for quite a while, hadn't he?
He was, and it's interesting because the 1970s saw quite a bit of foreign investment in Haiti, and there was a time when foreign companies began investing in factories and so forth. So it was an interesting period, but also one of continuing political repression that ended up in the overthrow in 86.
Well, he'd been in power from 71 to 86. So that's
a long period.
Absolutely.
What
sparked that rebellion?
Well, it was a series of things, but over the course of the 1980s, there was more and more open rebellion. In specific, there were a few school kids who were killed in Gonaïve during a protest, and that just kind of let loose a fierce uprising.
And what happened after he left?
Well, after he left, I mean, at first there's a remarkable new constitution that was written, which is a very important foundation, I think, for Haitian politics. But relatively quickly, the promise of elections was deferred. There was a kind of continuing military power and a long series of basically a power struggle that continued for years and years after that.
So the military saw this as its opportunity to rule.
Mm-hmm. A Haitian scholar, Michel Rothschild, talks about Duvalierism without Duvalier, and in some ways the same institutions were still very powerful in society.
It was felt that Jean-Bertrand Aristide would set things right. He was a priest, later mm-hmm. left the priesthood, but still he seemed to be not just a populist, but a man who had strong democratic ideals.
Mm-hmm.
Why did he turn out to be such a major disappointment?
Well, it's a very complicated question too. But that he was, you know, he came with a great deal of hope. He was in power very briefly after his election before a military coup. He then only returned during a U.S. occupation in 1994. And so the whole series of events, I think, also kind of hampered the possibilities that were available in the early 90s.
The first time he was in power, it was felt that he just hadn't dealt with the elites mm-hmm. in a sensible way, and they had enough power to get rid of him.
Yeah, I mean, there was obviously many people who were suspicious of him from the beginning, that played a role in that first coup. But it's, you know, then the series of events that happened afterwards continued to create a very difficult circumstance for him and for others.
And we went from one strong man to another until he returned to power.
He returned in 1994. Then in 1996, there was an election. He was replaced by Préval, who had worked closely with him. They then actually kind of grew apart at some point. And then he was elected again in 2000. It's actually a series of peaceful transfers of power that are pretty important and out of the ordinary in Haitian history. So we do need to remember that.
Well, were there positive changes in the country over those years?
I think that so many of the possibilities were essentially limited by the financial situation, by the continuing conflict on the ground. So there's a lot to be studied about that period to really understand what went wrong, but it's crucial that we do so.
My guest is Laurent Dubois, D-U-B-O-I-S. His book, Haiti, The Aftershocks of History, published by Metropolitan Books, WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We had this earthquake, mm-hmm. which revealed all of the problems that mm-hmm. Haiti still faced. Suddenly all the NGOs and various aid organizations descended on the island. Mm-hmm. And instead of cooperating, they seemed to all be in competition with each other.
Well, it is. It's a really troublesome situation, and we have a really dispersed and kind of fragmented form of giving aid. A lot of people with great intentions and trying to do good work, but I think the configuration as a whole needs to be really kind of revisited and rethought.
Ellen from Queens says that she doesn't see the results of the special envoy by Bill Clinton and all the other aid organizations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Clinton, you know, has a long connection with Haiti, and I think a lot of people put hope that he would really be able to help with reconstruction. But the IHRC and other groups have not really been able to deliver what was promised.
Was it appreciated when he kind of applied pressure on Haiti to take Aristide back?
Well, I think people did remember that and felt maybe that it was necessary at that time, although...
That appreciated?
Yeah. Well, I think it's very ambiguous for a lot of Haitians because, you know, maybe supported but also very difficult to take at the same time. So there's, you know, given the memory of the U.S. occupation from before and the whole – and then there's been a foreign military presence in the form of a U.N. mission since then, which has been the source of a lot of tension as well.
Do Haitians feel that they're judged poorly by the rest of the world?
I think so. I think, you know, Haitians – I begin with Louis-Joseph Janvier, who in the 1880s already was kind of attacking the vision of Haiti in the world. Haitians are, I think, rightly concerned with the stereotypes and negative depictions of their country that really have a political effect too.
Amy from Manhattan asks, when was the first black ambassador received in a Western country, and what country was that ambassador from?
I believe it was when Haitian ambassadors started coming in the 1860s. And actually, the first American ambassadors to Haiti were African Americans and some of the highest ranking African Americans in the government at the time. So it went both ways, kind of these innovations.
Was that appreciated by the Haitians?
They did, yes. There were many African Americans, including Frederick Douglass was actually, I tell his story in the book, was ambassador to Haiti. And many of them were very sympathetic to Haiti and I think remain very respected there. There's streets named after them and so forth.
How powerful has the brain drain been on Haiti? So many people have left. And in New York, we see it with an awful lot of professionals here mm-hmm. who are Haitian Americans now.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the very, you know, devastating consequences of the Duvalier years was this massive migration, especially of professionals at first. Figuring out how the Haitian diaspora and Haiti can kind of work together is one of the great challenges of the 21st century.
But do you see the earthquake as having a positive effect in that it forced everyone to look at what was going on there and try to find ways to set things right for the long term?
Well, I think there was that possibility after the earthquake. Until now, I don't feel like we've really seen that. And it was one of the reasons I wrote the book, was to think really in the long term about the future of Haiti. But it certainly does, I think, if we really want to participate in reconstruction effectively, we're going to need to reevaluate the way we do things.
Antonio from Bayside says his mother was born in Haiti in 1940, and she described going to school with a very diverse population, Arabs, Italians, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Did those groups interact well?
Yeah, I mean, urban Haiti in the 19th and 20th century was very diverse, very cosmopolitan, very international. And you know, many Haitian families have these very complex and interesting roots. So, I mean, that's not an image of Haiti people often have here, but it was a very exciting place and a kind of capital within the Caribbean, too, intellectually and culturally.
What do you think it's going to take to get people to go back to Haiti, to the resorts? First of all, have those hotels been repaired?
There are big projects for hotel reconstruction and repair and new hotels going up. And certainly there's always a hope that the tourism that we once had could be rebuilt.
Probably just as important would be some kind of plan to reforest the country, the sort of thing that we saw in Kenya. But is that likely?
There are some really good projects that are underway for reforestation. To me, that's really the vital. I mean, not just reforestation, but the kind of invigoration of the rural sector and rural agriculture could really be a great foundation for other economic developments in Haiti.
Laurent Dubois' book, Haiti, The Aftershocks of History, is published by Metropolitan Books. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.